My test of people's religion is this. I push until they get angry, and then I found their religion. I found the thing that they think is so true that it makes them angry if other people don't accept it. You know, especially when somebody is angry at religion, you know, you people are so ridiculous. Then it really is usually a matter of 6 or 7 questions at the most to get to the point where they are demanding that other people behave as they prescribe. They really believe that people who don't behave the way they think they should behave are wrong and should be punished. Even the most tolerant people, we believe in tolerance, you know, they are completely intolerant when you hit them in their religion. Everyone has a religion. Everyone has a set of beliefs that they think the rest of the world should live by. And the secret to life here is finding out what your own religion really is and perhaps adapting it and learning what your religion should be in order to get along with other people. What actually are the set of stories that when people live them, they function better as a community, they thrive, they're happy. That's religion.
This is Infants on Thrones. The philosophies of men mingled with humans. We are the core.
Hi everyone, I'm Bob Caswell, and today I want to talk about the book Ender's Game, which is now also a $110 million big budget movie. Actually, what I really want to discuss is the book's author, Orson Scott Card, and what I want to do is I want to use him and his book as a proxy for the air quotes topic of the day, Mormon success. Did you catch it? It was in air quotes. Let me say it one more time. We're talking about Mormon success. So, as you might have guessed by now, the opening audio of this episode was Orson Scott Card himself pontificating on the nature of religion. And I have to say, I really kind of loved it. To me, this is classic Orson Scott Card. Growing up Mormon, he was a big deal for me. He was an inspirational figure who really served as the North Star of this concept of Mormon success. But before I get into that, I really should define what I mean by Mormon success. I think most anyone who has experienced growing up Mormon has also experienced what I'm going to call the Mormon inverse inferiority complex. Okay, stick with me. I know this is a lot of terms. Well, it's really just two. But what is this Mormon inverse inferiority complex, you might ask? In a nutshell, Mormons, and really only Mormons, of course, we all know this, have the exclusive way to unlock the vast riches of eternity. We're talking eternal life in the celestial kingdom. But you know, we remain a tiny fraction of the world's population and constantly live with this tension of wanting so desperately to be recognized. By your fruits you shall know them and all of that. So one of the best ways to get the other 99.9% of the world to notice you is to be successful on their terms. I think the main roots of this inexplicit ideology started, I'd say, probably around the time of David O. McKay, when he was prophet and president of the Mormon Church. And maybe it's just a coincidence, it's a little bit of a tangent, but David O. McKay, he was really the first prophet since Joseph Smith to go with the clean-shaven route, with a full head of hair. He's got a nice, dapper, and charming look. Dare I say, he's kind of the Uchtdorf of his day? I mean, go and check out the prophet profile pics and tell me I'm wrong.
That's hot.
Anyway, what I'm trying to say is that the church as a whole at some point moved into this inverse inferiority complex phase. I know I could tell growing up, maybe I wouldn't have called it that, but we really, really wanted to be so amazing in terms the world could understand because we were amazing. I just have to keep saying it to myself. They just didn't know it yet. I mean, yeah, sure, read the Book of Mormon, pray about it. We're the one true church. Blah, blah, blah. But just in case that isn't quite enough, did you know BYU is referred to as the Harvard of the West? Complete with dramatic pauses. What was that? You haven't heard that? And you want a source that isn't from inside the Mormon Church? Okay, well, I've got some stats for you on how Utah compares to the rest of the U.S. in terms of... Wait, what are you telling me? Utah's at the top of the list for depression and pornography usage? Well, I mean, have you looked at the tax rates? The cost of living? I mean, it's... Okay, stop laughing. So there you have it. That, for me, is the Mormon inverse inferiority complex. The confidence to know that we must be toward the top of all the lists that matter most. And notwithstanding any counterexample, it didn't really matter, especially to me, growing up with the truth. I had it. I had the truth. People were missing out, and subconsciously, part of my existence I knew was to somehow proselytize in a way that my very success would validate this truth I already had, well before I would proselytize in the more traditional way at the age of 19. And here's where I want to come back to Orson Scott Card. I remember when I read Ender's Game, because it's really the only book I've ever read all at once. As a teen, I stayed up all night and devoured it. I also remember really wanting to be like him, that is, wanting to write. I even got to meet him in person. Well, truth be told, it wasn't just me and him in a room or anything. I mean, it was a pretty full room. But if it were the old me growing up, I would have said it the other way. I got to meet him in person, and you assume the best case scenario. Anyway, it was a great writing workshop for teens. I had a great time. He was an amazing guest speaker and moderator. But more importantly, I wanted to be successful like that, wanting to show the world just how much better they could be, too, if only they were Mormons, because naturally, being Mormon was part of the reason I was going to have a leg up in the world, which they would naturally also see. Which is just like how I assumed it mattered in the same way for Orson Scott Card. In reality, I have no idea if or how Mormonism had anything to do with Card's success. And let's be honest, the jury is pretty mixed when it comes to just how much Mormonism might matter any more or less than a bazillion other factors when it comes to being successful in life. In fact, I'm actually being pretty generous. It probably doesn't matter at all. But even to this day, there's a part of me that still roots for Mormon success, and I get super excited when a movie starring Harrison Ford and Ben Kingsley is only possible because a Mormon wrote the story behind it. In fact, I'm part of another podcast called Practically Culture, where we talk about current movies and typically choose a new movie each week to review. Now, even though this podcast is hosted by a couple of dudes who both grew up Mormon, rarely does Mormonism have anything to do with it or come up as a topic. But with our review of Ender's Game, well, even now, all these many years later, we really had to do our best to separate our regular movie watching selves from our Mormon success roots. Have a listen.
Ender's Game. The international military seeks out a leader who can save the human race from an alien attack. Ender Wiggin, a brilliant young mind, is recruited and trained to lead his fellow soldiers into a battle that will determine the future of Earth. Starring Asa Butterfield, best known for his role in Hugo, Harrison Ford, and Ben Kingsley, written and directed by Gavin Hood, who directed X-Men Origins Wolverine. Was that one of the X-Men movies you liked, by the way, Bob?
It was in the middle.
Okay. And we should, of course, mention that the screenplay is based on a novel by Orson Scott Card. Ender's Game is a movie I have a hard time reviewing objectively, Bob. More so, really, than any movie since at least Star Trek Into Darkness, and maybe even including that movie. It's one of the few movies where my fandom interferes with my judgment. Did you feel any of that, or am I alone on that?
No, I'm glad you're bringing this up. I felt similarly, even though I haven't read the book in a number of years. Honestly, like, literally, what, 15 years? But it's a very important book to me. And, you know, as a teen, I loved the story. And I've gone back to it, even if I haven't read it, you know, start to finish since then. How about you?
Oh, absolutely. I don't even necessarily walk around thinking of myself as an Ender's Game fan. But just when I watched the movie, I felt myself going into that watching as a fan mode. The other thing we have to talk about before we get into the movie, though, and I think we'll get more of our fandom and more of our whole background with this book, but I think we should talk about Orson Scott Card, who, of course, wrote the book Ender's Game. Now, Orson Scott Card, of course, is a Mormon, like we were growing up, and Ender's Game was one of the first grown-up books I read as a teenager, and that it was written by a Mormon made it even more important as a rite of passage for me. I don't know if we've ever really even talked about this, you and me, since we were both teenagers when we read it, but how important was Ender's Game to you growing up, Bob?
Well, it was huge, and Orson Scott Card was part of the reason for that. I mean, I don't know that you and I have actually discussed this since our own exodus out of Mormonism, if we want to call it that, as a shorthand form of where we are in life now. And for the record, I'm pretty sure Orson Scott Card is still an active, believing, practicing Mormon. So we've gone our separate ways. But when we were in our youth, when I was in my youth, he was always the guy that was quirky, open-minded, which I know that's kind of a loaded term, open-minded, but he could just get away with saying all sorts of crazy stuff, but not crazy always in a bad way, although there's some of that, and maybe we can get to it, but crazy in like a, I didn't think of that in that way, or you just read some of the themes that come out of his books, because I've read a number of his books, and he could say things that were very meaningful to me and made me think and question and really critically start analyzing the world in certain ways that maybe I wouldn't have, dare I say. I don't want to overemphasize this man's influence on my life, but he was definitely up there in terms of role models of, you know, people that helped influence me and where I went in my life, especially in the early years.
Yeah, it's sort of surprising how much that is looking back. You know, when I read the book Ender's Game, it seemed like so many grown-ups I knew, from my uncles to random Mormon congregation members to people at school, they all spoke in these hushed tones like, oh, I see, you're finally reading Ender's Game. Welcome to membership in the club. And I felt really cool for reading it. Oh, I'm a big boy now. And like, right. As you talk about Orson Scott Card, he himself was a serious role model. The way I would put it, the way I thought of it, very much in the spirit of what you said, but he was like famous and he was well regarded in his field of science fiction writing without having to write explicitly Mormon stuff, you know, and that almost seemed like a tension there, but I thought it was really cool that he could pull that off.
Yeah, like he seemed super edgy, almost irreverent, and kind of an iconoclast in that he didn't just conform to the to the, you know, role models that we were supposed to have, like, you know, Jesus Christ or someone else that's like some person in the leadership of the Mormon church that would act and behave a certain way and you could spot it a mile away like every other leader in the Mormon church. I mean, they have their own little personalities too, but nowhere near the level of freedom that Orson Scott Card somehow got away with by being both, but still being both a active believing representative almost of Mormonism to the outside world, but still being on the inside, you know, a guy who was a Mormon like the rest of us. And I always looked up to him for that, like, yeah, see, you know, there's that Mormon phrase of being in the world, but not of the world, or I don't even remember exactly how we said it, but like you could bridge those two worlds together in a way that makes it so that people realize how awesome Mormons are. They're normal people too, and even better than normal people. Look at Orson Scott Card for proof.
Yeah. Orson Scott Card was the guy who was the aspirational model for us all to look up to. And this is, you know, really an Ender's Game review, not necessarily an Orson Scott Card review. But the one other thing I think we should mention is, you know, as I grew up and I left my Mormon framework, I started hearing about Orson Scott Card in a different way. And you mentioned crazy, but not necessarily crazy bad before. But then it started to go crazy a little bit. In particular, he became a very strong, outspoken opponent of gay marriage. And where I once thought he, like you said, was the perfect example of how someone could be Mormon while still being quote unquote normal, he started to become someone I was embarrassed by to some extent. I don't know if you have anything you want to say about, you know, like post 2000-ish Orson Scott Card, but it's worth mentioning that he's a little more controversial these days.
Yeah, same for me. I'm not sure what happened. In fact, in preparation for this podcast, I was kind of reviewing or researching, trying to figure out like when did the switch get flipped, and was he this way in the 80s, and maybe when he was less successful and you know, couldn't speak up. Is this something that's always been the Orson Scott Card that he is, or did something change? There's some theories out there for people who really want to get into it, like after 9/11, this is how it changed him. And I don't really subscribe to that as that much of a reason or the main reason. Maybe it's part of the influence like it is for anyone, but anyway, I feel like, and then the internet came along, maybe he just didn't have as much of a microphone before because he was a writer, but now he's like a writer that's writing articles for political type news outlets more so than, you know, fiction. And in fact, I found an interesting interview that he gave recently where he sort of explained the difference of how he gets in a mindset for writing science fiction versus how he approaches just writing about whatever random shit he feels like, which actually really helped me because he's compartmentalizing in a very interesting way, and I'm going to butcher because it's pretty long and thought out, but the long and the short of it is he sees the topics that he addresses in his science fiction more as mythic truths, and he has his own definition for what that means, but things that are that really connect us, and on an individual basis, people have different types of mythic truths, but there's a lot of universal themes in humanity that he really draws upon when he writes these books that aren't necessarily so polarizing or opinionated or, and we'll get into this maybe with the review of the movie, some of the themes that aren't necessarily controversial in the same way that political stuff is controversial. So he thinks those truths, quote unquote, are on a different level and more universal than the quote unquote truths he subscribes to as opinions more so when it comes to politics or economics or stuff like that. And I got to say, you know, that's an easy answer for why you can be crazy in one side of your life and you know, prolific as a writer on the other side of your life. But for lack of a better way of explaining it all away, it's sort of working for me. I don't know. How did it sound?
Yeah, actually, I'm glad you you said that he thinks of it that way, because I sort of think of it that way too, even though that doesn't necessarily absolve him of all the craziness. But yeah, I suppose I agree with that, the way you put it.
Cool, cool.
But let's get to the movie, Bob. Do you have a mini review for us? I'm dying to know what you thought of this movie.
Yeah, here's my mini review. Ender's Game. I give you a 4 out of 5, and here's what I have to say. 15 years ago, this could have been my favorite movie. Nowadays, it's just great. I love the scenes that focus on tactics and strategy, which really kept me focused away from how hard it must be to film tweens effectively. So there you go. How about yours? Now I want to hear yours and see where we go from there.
All right. Well-crafted to appeal to fans of the book. They got most of the themes right and included as many parts as possible, even if each aspect was clipped to keep the length under control. I could see it being different for those unfamiliar with the book, though. The pace might be too quick and clipped to get what's going on. That said, I'm an unabashed fan. 4 stars.
Nice. Now, I love how we came to the same... We're pretty much on the same page, but we focused on different things and they're very complimentary reviews, because I agree with everything you said just as much as I agree with my own words. So that's good.
Yeah. So for me, this reminds me of my Star Trek Into Darkness review, in that the fan in me and the movie critic in me saw it significantly differently. And I wonder if that's the case for you, Bob.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. But tell me more. I want to see.
Yeah. Okay. So the fan in me was giddy. I really, really loved it as a fan, I have to say. It's, you know, it's actually been quite a while since I've read the book, like you were saying, but it took me right back, and the little bits and pieces we got of much longer parts in the book, you know, that brought me right back to reading it, you know, in my bedroom and remembering vast other parts of the story. You know, I don't know if I realized it at the time when I was reading the book as a teenager, but I actually think I might have unconsciously identified with Ender a fair amount, you know, in the way a kid might identify with a superhero with superpowers that only have to be discovered, and you have to have a secret identity that you show the world to hide your true potential. Well, Ender might have been my own superhero, come to think of it. A super smart kid who was isolated and put through hell but had the potential to save humanity. I think I sort of fantasized about that same sort of self-narrative, but only looking back at it now can I see where that may have come from, and it just, I don't know. It resonated with me a ton.
Yeah, me too. And I don't want to like overgeneralize, but I think there's some Mormonness also in that coming of age story that a lot of people have growing up in Utah, like you and I both did, at least. So I'm going to stereotype a little bit, but it's okay, because it's toward my own people, so to speak, right? So then you're allowed to do that kind of stuff. But I think there is like a sense of competitiveness and save the world longing that good Mormon boys think about when growing up, like, you know, we're different, and why are there so few of us, and the rest of the world doesn't really give us the credibility we give ourselves, and we're gonna prove it. And like Ender the character is kind of the embodiment of that. Is, I mean, it's not, there's nothing to do with Mormonism in the book, but it was easy to project myself or really resonate with the character, because I had my own way of portraying my life story and how I could get out there and represent for Mormons at the same time as saving the world in my own little way.
So yeah, that really tests something in me, and tests something in my teenager self especially. But as a movie, like I said in the mini review, I worry that the very quick pace might be too much for someone who isn't already a fan. And I'll also say at the end, when Ender's personal focus changes from his initial purpose, and I'm trying to stay spoiler-free here, it felt sort of rushed and maybe not quite earned. That part of Ender was always there, of course, but in trying to fit everything in a short period in the movie, I'm not sure the right groundwork was laid for everything. And that part doesn't necessarily follow, at least as the movie portrays it.
Right, absolutely. I totally agree with you. And this is where I have to insert my standard disclaimer where, you know, I need to be self-aware that I'm about to do the book was much better than the movie sort of line. But that's one of those scenes. The last 10 minutes was really difficult for me. I don't want to steer people away from the movie because it's fine enough and it wraps up in a movie wrap up sort of way that's as best as it can be. But there is some change in direction, and it sort of has to gloss over like a lot of stuff that is covered in the book, which I don't know how else they could have done it other than not deal with that part and maybe end it a little earlier after a certain climatic scene. But now we're getting into, you know, editing decisions, and I can understand what they were going for, and it was fine enough, but yeah, and it's hard for me to imagine somebody watching it without having the backstory of the book.
Right.
They might be kind of like, have a little bit of a huh, or a hmm, that was kind of weird or rushed, or what was that exactly at the end?
Yeah, and along those lines, that someone who hasn't seen the book might not appreciate as much, I'm a little sad that we didn't get to see all the relationships with like the other Battle School kids develop like we did in the book. So I personally knew how special everyone was from reading the book, but I'm not sure you'd really get that from the movie otherwise.
I just remember it being a very adult themed book. And I was like you said at the beginning, learning things and experiencing very complicated themes when I was reading this as a kid myself. Yeah. But then seeing it the other way around, now that I'm an adult 15 years later and watching kids portray it, I'm like, no, it's more serious than that. You gotta, let's do another take. I didn't like how that came across.
Fair enough. A little bit more like Marlon Brando, please.
Right. You 10-year-old.
Yeah, I get it. So, I mean, I don't know if it's time. I guess I'm feeling like it's sort of close to wrapping up. If you want to bring up anything more after I give my final thoughts, you're more than welcome to. But you know how it seems like movie adaptations usually have one of two choices? They either try to be as true to the book as possible, or they try to stand on their own as a movie. I think this one went pretty far in the true to the book direction, pleasing fans, but maybe giving up on its potential as a movie. I don't think that they're going to look at this one as some great feat of filmmaking even 5 years down the road. But if you've read the book and love it, by all means, go watch the movie because you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add to that because I think that was well said and I totally agree. This movie works great for fans of the book. You can nitpick, and we already did, about the ending maybe and how it cuts out some things and is quickly paced. As for people who are like, you know, what's the big deal? Why should I love this movie? Yeah, we get it, you people. I've been in that camp too, where somebody's like, oh, you're not a fan of the book. And I watched the movie and I'm like, man, it was okay. And this is easily one of those movies that could be forgettable and man, okay, or maybe slightly better than okay for the average crowd. But that's just the way it goes with adaptations. And I think overall I'm pleased. And you know, the Mormon in me is yearning for more. Like, I want this to be like an Oscar contender, but then there's the film side of me that's like, please. And I'm rolling my eyes at myself. Like, what, are you crazy? No, not in a million years. So that's what I have to say about it.
All right. Rock and roll.
So there you have it. Oh, Mormon success. I just can't seem to quit you. By the way, if you like what you heard, you could find more movie talk and movie reviews at practicallyculture.com or look for us on Facebook or iTunes. So I feel like there are a couple more things I need to address when it comes to Orson Scott Card. The first is that, well, Orson, that's weird. Can I call you Orson? I mean, Brother Card, I don't think you realize how much you might have indirectly influenced my exit from Mormonism. You really were the best of both worlds. You had the credibility of the brethren. There are those air quotes again. Let me say that again. You had the credibility of the brethren calling on you to write the script for the Hill Cumorah pageant. for any non-Mormons, that's practically like the Pope choosing someone to write a script for a documentary about the Catholic Church. At least that's how I remember being told about it. This and everything else I already talked about really went a long way to setting you up for having quite the Mormon street cred. But let me explain what I mean about your influence on my exit. Don't worry, I'm just giving you a little credit. It's actually a long, complicated story, as you might imagine, and we're not going to get into it here. But I remember your book, Saints Speak, The Mormon Dictionary, published in 1981, before Ender's Game and way before any of your more recent controversies. This is the most brilliant piece of Mormon satire I have ever read. Thank you. I discovered it in my teens, around the same time as Ender's Game, in fact. I wish it wasn't out of print. I highly recommend this to anyone who has anything to do with Mormonism. I'd say about 80% of it is still just as relevant today, more than 30 years later, and that's impressive. Let me read a few of my favorite excerpts that I loved back then as a true-believing Mormon, and I still love today as whatever I am now. So let's start with doctrine. So by the way, as you can tell by the title, this is the Mormon Dictionary. So these are entries in the Mormon Dictionary. Doctrine. Any idea that I have about the gospel, even if I can't find it in the scriptures, because I'm sure someone said it in general conference sometime. See dogma. And you read under dogma. Any idea that you try to get me to believe just because somebody said it in general conference sometime. See doctrine. Love it. Okay. Let's look at Golden Question. Golden Question. What do you know about the Mormon Church? Would you like to know more? A question Mormons regularly ask non-Mormons, but rarely think to ask themselves. Next up, Journal of Discourses. You can tell that this one's going to be great. A mammoth collection of speeches by general authorities in the 19th century containing many doctrines that were never taught in the church. As a safety measure, it was once suppressed by the church for several once bright people had gone mad trying to make all the old-time apostles' statements fit within the same gospel. Today, however, there is no fear of ill effects from publishing the Journal of Discourses, for only fundamentalists, anti-Mormons, and historians ever read it. Well, I wouldn't call myself anti-Mormon, but people once affiliated with Mormonism also may read it. So, what else do we have here? Okay, this is probably my favorite one. We're going to go with knowledge. So, gosh, I'm losing my place in the book here. Knowledge. The ultimate... I'm going to have to try to make it through this without laughing. Knowledge. The ultimate level of certainty, much stronger than faith. It means that you have had faith in something so long that you can't remember ever thinking about it, and you certainly don't intend to start now. I just don't know why. That makes me crack up every time. Okay, just a few more, because these are just too good for you not to hear them, dear listener. Mob. A group of people whipped into such a frenzy by evil leaders that they are incapable of reason or empathy in their urge to destroy an innocent victim. Not to be confused with groups of concerned citizens who are so inspired in righteous indignation by defenders of morality that they have no further need of discussion or delay in their crusade to destroy the forces of sin. Two sides of the same coin. Okay, how about non-Mormons? A classic. People that you're supposed to convert to the gospel, but in the meantime, don't let their children go out with yours. Rebellious spirit? Well, that sounds like something applicable. What tempts some Mormons to think before doing what they're told? Yeah. Seer stone. Whew, a little long, but this one's worth it. Seer stone. Every Mormon child has heard about the Urim and Thummim, which every child's also mispronounced it, but almost no one is ever told about the seer stone, probably because the Urim and Thummim had more class. After all, great prophets had once owned the Urim and Thummim, while Joseph Smith just picked up the seer stone from the ground one day and kept it in his hat. It looked for all the world like an ordinary rock. Not at all impressive. So no doubt the seer stone was only used to translate the dull sections of the Book of Mormon. I'll just let it speak for itself there. Okay, and the final two, Spirit of contention. What it is when you disagree with a church leader. See Spirit of love. Spirit of love. What it is when a church leader disagrees with you. See Spirit of contention. You know, in retrospect, this book brings up a lot of emotions for me. It's weird, I know. But the types of things you just heard, I kind of miss them. And this book was my first safe, in quotes, it really was, my first safe way to self-reflect on what my religion really was full of. And it planted the seeds for, you know, more of that thinking and reading and researching and analyzing that came much later. So once again, thank you, Orson Scott Card. So what about now? What do I think of Orson Scott Card now with all his current controversies? At first, I was thinking about reading a bunch of his more controversial quotes on homosexuality, global warming denial, and, you know, Hitler-Obama comparisons for good measure. But the truth is, I don't think that's really going to get us very far. And I'm not here to defend him, even if I fully expect to be misinterpreted like Card often feels he is. So, where does that leave us? You see, Card still writes both his fiction, which honestly is less controversial, and his, whatever you want to call everything else he writes. And although I disagree with him in all the ways you might expect, that is, just to be clear, I'm going to attempt not to be misunderstood, I have no issues with gay marriage, nor do I deny global warming as an important topic, and lastly, I don't really condone the use of Hitler as an appropriate comparison to Obama. Standard disclaimer aside, all that said, I actually still respect Card, and I enjoy reading all his writing, both his fiction and his random musings. I've been reading his column, which he writes for his local newspaper in North Carolina and posts on his website. I've been reading that column. It's called Uncle Orson Reviews Everything. I still read it and have been reading it for the last 10 years. The truth is, I still value his opinion immensely, but that's not the same thing as endorsing it or approving of it. And if you were to read his nonfiction writing like I do, you'd realize that most of the time he's more interesting than he is controversial. He's a damn good writer. And even when controversial, the points he makes are generally long and thought out with complex and nuanced points that generally sound much worse than they are when they are read as short excerpts. But again, that said, it doesn't make me agree with him anymore, but I do try to understand him. So what's the point? The point is Orson Scott Card kind of nutty? Maybe. Sort of. But you know, I wonder if his nuttiness, in any average nuttiness out there among you and me, is that he just so happens to wear his on his sleeve unapologetically and proudly, for better or for worse. And his sleeve happens to be a bit closer to a microphone than any of our sleeves. But when it comes to successful Mormons, real live Mormons, actively living the religion and contributing to society in some way notable or meaningful, which would you rather embrace? Orson Scott Card? Or that one guy who I think was good looking, but I really can't remember. And he always seemed overly cheery. Oh, and he sings pretty well too. You know, that's pretty much all I know about him. He's Mormon and he's famous. What was his name? Donnie someone? As Orson Scott Card says in Saints Speak, under the definition for Osmondize, quote, "To give something such a slick, polished surface appearance that no one will notice there isn't any substance underneath," end quote. I, for one, prefer my Mormonism cardified. Anyone for the closing prayer?